Hello everyone and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business and esports. It's episode 21 and we are joined by two awesome guests for this episode. I've mentioned quite a few times over the course of the last four or five episodes about the National Esports Tournament that we have going on in the UK, and to shed a little bit more light on that, how that tournament came to be and what the kind of social impact of this setup could be, I've brought on two guests. First, Shanila Saeed, the head of education for Yuki, and secondly, the person who actually persuaded me to come onto the program, Deborah from Space Ape Games. Guys, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. At the start of every episode, we try and tell everyone a little bit more about yourself. So why don't you take us through your story, how you got to where you are now, and your history as a gamer and your past life.
Oh, my goodness.
Who wants to go first?
my past life. I'm actually a teacher by profession. And sort of a computer science teacher, and sort of the opportunity came up to shape and to lead this new idea called the Digital Schoolhouse Program, and it was something that I just couldn't resist. This take a gem of an idea and take it literally from ground up, from nothing, and shape it into a national program, which was my ambition. It was one of the first things I think I said to my CEO. And she said, what do you want? I said, well, I want to take it outside of London and I want to make it contagious. I want there to be digital schoolhouses all over the country. So that's this very short version of my history and so where I've come from. But in terms of gaming, I'm more of a casual gamer, although I have loved playing games since I can remember. My first console was this small little purple handheld thing, and it only ever played Snoopy. Okay. But it to this day, I think it's got to be my favourite one. I don't know why. It's just...
Everyone's got those kind of special moments from when they got started. Deb, what about yourself? How did you get stuck in?
Well, I'm actually a journalist by background. So I was a print and TV journalist for, like 6-7 years. And then that was over in Canada, the Great North. And then... I moved back to Europe, first to Germany and then to London, and kind of fell into gaming, actually. It wasn't really planned, but Xbox was looking for somebody with an editorial background who spoke a few different languages, and so I ended up joining their team for Xbox Upload, which was like a video sharing and editing platform on the Xbox One. And so I was, a producer, a content creator, presenting lots of different things like that, and helped to grow that community. And then once our studio unfortunately closed down, then I moved over to Space Ape, where I am now, and do similar things. So a lot of like content creation, production, some presenting stuff as well. I run our live streams, and I also get to... come up with different events and stuff for the studio. And yeah, I guess one of the things I'm really keen on is like the intersection of games and education. So that's...
And how did you get stuck in as a coach? Because you were the one that, if we're going to go with the it's massively contagious thing, you're the one that infected me with this idea of actually getting involved. So yeah, just tell me a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. I do a lot of stuff with the Yuki, actually. I'm sort of, I guess, one of the main liaisons between our studio and Yuki. And I think I met Shanila at another Yuki event, I'm not sure, and she was telling me about Digital Schoolhouse, or she was giving me a presentation. I can't remember exactly how it happened. And I was like, this is amazing. I have to get involved. I'm such a keener to get involved with things all the time. So I basically just harassed Shanila and was like, how can I get involved? And I also volunteer with the literacy group outside of work. So yeah, I love working with kids and stuff. But yeah, no, I love working with kids, and I find that, sometimes you'll go in there and you're trying to teach them something or help them with something, and then it sounds really cheesy, but like you leave and you leave actually having learned something from them. And I remember all of my good teachers when I was growing up and like the effect they had on me, and I felt like if I can do that for somebody in some small way, then that is amazing. So yeah, I always love working with kids in any sort of educational capacity. And that's how I got involved with DSH as well. They were looking for coaches for this esports tournament. And I love games. I love esports. And I was like, that's me. I'll do it. And then after that, I was like, do you guys need more people? So I was like, Joe, you're doing it too. And then I reached out to some, oh, actually my colleague Pablo as well. I was like, Pablo, you're doing it too. So yeah, I kind of recruited a few people into the program because I think it's amazing. So.
Thank you very much.
That's that was a sweet. Long, rambly answer, wasn't
it? It's all good. It's all good. So why don't we just take a step back from where we're at now and just explore how the concept of ESH actually came to be. Who was driving this forward? Was this something that you were kind of pitched when you stepped into Yuki, or was this kind of like an idea that was already bubbling in the background, and how did it really reach the scale that it has today with over 20 schools?
31 schools.
31 schools across all the UK. Thousands of kids that are getting involved. Yeah, just how did we get to this milestone?
Gosh, it all started way back when. No, it was, Digital Schoolhouse was actually a project that initially began life at Langley Grammar School in Slough, sort of back in 2006 and 2008. And it was run by a single teacher, a guy called Mark Dorling, who's sort of quite well known amongst the computing education community. And he was tasked by his head teacher to run computing workshops for local kids from local schools. And the reason they wanted to do it was because they wanted to support their local schools and sort of raise their profile a little bit more as well. So it ran for a year or something. And then around that time, actually, there was a lot of things happening in computing education. There was a huge body of people, or a small body of people, actually, that were really pushing for change on the computing curriculum to get rid of this idea that we were becoming Microsoft Office ambassadors and to actually teach proper computing and programming. And what Mark did was he used the Digital Schoolhouse as a platform to experiment and to really try and prove this point that you can teach computing to primary school kids. It was successful. It was featured in the Royal Society report. And it was so successful, Mark was offered a job somewhere else and Digital Schoolhouse then shut down.
As happens with quite a few successful...
As happens.
Yeah.
On the other side of the coin, Yuki, where Yuki comes into all of this is... Yuki, as you know, was worked on the Next Gen Skills campaign and sort of commissioned the report there. And, you know, post-report, there's a lot of recommendations that went into report about how we can improve computing education and that we should improve computing education. And after that, it was a case of, well, we've said this and now we really want to do something about it as well. So... they sort of joined forces with there's this idea that, you know, they found this germ of an idea that had operated quite successfully in one school for about 2 years and then nothing happened out of it. And the Mayor of London was looking to raise the excellence of education in London schools. So Yuki secured the bid for the Mayor of London and the Mayor of London sort of seed funded the programme. And the idea was that Digital Schoolhouse to test to see whether it was scalable as an idea. Because it operated as a one single school project.
Sure.
But is this something that can actually work? They needed someone to make that happen, and that's when I came in.
Awesome. Very, very exciting stuff. And then where does esports actually come into the agenda with a national esports tournament? Because that's, whilst it's inspiring for kids, and like you're going to have a bunch of people that will have exposure to, you know, running social media accounts, even if it is all memes, or like bringing all of their school communities together. How does a national esports tournament actually play into kind of inspiring these kids, or actually having an impact on the high level of skill?
So
and expertise. Sorry.
The esports sort of tournament. Sort of the germ of the idea began about towards the tail end of 2016. And it was when I saw the work of one of my schools. I was visiting one of my digital schoolhouses and I was speaking to the teacher. We were interrupted by a student and the sort of teacher stopped our meeting and spoke to the student. And when the student left, by way of explaining And apologising that the teacher explained that. So I'm sorry, I run this club and actually the kids run it and I just facilitate it. But, you know, a couple of kids, they get into teams. It's a bit like football league, but they play FIFA and other people come and watch and then I give them a trophy and I'm really sorry. It's just a tiny little thing. But and I was listening to this teacher and realised that. And I thought to myself, and at that time, I was very new to esports. I'm still very new to esports. But I'd been working at Yuki long enough to be able to recognise what was going on. And realised, and I'm thinking, that's esports. I'm sure that's what he's describing, that's esports. I went back to the office because I spoke to my colleagues and spoke to staff people in the industry. And that's where the idea came about. And actually, if this one teacher can do it with a group of kids, and he's talking about seeing the excitement in those children, then actually what would happen if we raised the game of this and actually had different schools competing off against each other and had a tournament? And so we did that. We ran a pilot last year with four schools. We had 460 kids taking part in those four schools alone. The interest and the enthusiasm was phenomenal. It just completely blew me away. But why do we do this? And it's careers education. I kind of go with the idea that students cannot aspire to a career they don't know exists. And I think there's a lot of students and there's a lot of children out there and young people out there that really are literally not aware of the wealth of career opportunities available within not just esports, but the game sector and the games community. And if they, you know, if they think about game development, it's, I want to make a game. Yeah. And that's it. That's kind of the be-all and end-all. It's like, you know, I'm a game maker is a single job title. There's no other job titles there. But so I think we as an industry need to be more vocal and more outspoken and more mainstream about our careers advice.
I remember being in the back of my parents' car when I was about 7 years old. And I said, Dad, I want to work in the games industry. And like, I wanted to be a games tester. And that was literally all I could think of. Mm. Didn't have any wider business understanding about, you know, all of the various tech stuff, all the marketing, speaking to the community. So it does make a lot more sense to kind of speak in that way. And actually speaking in the kids' own language as well, like you're not just having someone go and do like a very dry lecture. You're actually, it's a organic experience that they can learn through. I can see just if one kid gets a massive amount of satisfaction, even if their team gets knocked out, but if they're the one who's doing the Instagram account, doing the memes, or if they're the one that's really enjoyed bringing people together, or like working out one little obstacle that they've had to overcome to make the...
Yeah, it's about informing them about the world of the career opportunities by immersing them in that world. Yeah. And it's we're not expecting every student to go and want to become a pro esports player or an event manager or something. But actually, it's about opening the door. It's about switching that light bulb on. And it's like, I thought to myself last year, if there was even one kid that turned around and sort of had this idea that, you know, I just didn't know. I didn't know. I thought, that's it. I've done that. I've won that goal. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. But the amount of soft skills that are being sort of developed, and we're getting students to actually become the event organisers for this in the school based stage. So
what's the roadmap that we're on? The regional play is starting as soon as we get all of the PCs and the hardware out there, which we might talk about in a second. But when's the grand final? When's and what platforms will this be on? If people want to tune in.
Yeah, so we've got the sort of school heats based stage happening at the moment. In March, we'll have the regional qualifiers. We'll have those at sort of different venues across the country. And then we'll be coming together at Easter for the grand final in London.
Okay, awesome. Will this be getting the full esports experience? Or do they have like...
Absolutely. Okay. I think when I speak to our partners, it's always in a very interesting conversation. I thank them so much for their patience with me. They say to me, Shia, what do you want from this? And I say to them, well, I want the kids to go, wow. I want it to be as professional as an experience as we can possibly make it. Yeah. Because that's the real thing. We've had, you know, a school atmosphere is one thing, but a professional atmosphere is completely different. I want to blow their minds away. And hopefully we'll be doing that in awesome. The knockout stages.
I'm very excited to, one, see my school in Southend start playing. They were very excited. And also to see the hype. I'm expecting rage. I'm expecting a little enthusiasm. They're from your, yeah, hopefully not tears, but there might be because it's going to be huge. Deb, from your experience shooting down to your school, which is where, sorry?
Townley Grammar.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you were saying that it's got a very strong girls component to everyone who's signing up. It was one of the first questions I asked when I went to the South End. How many girls have we got involved? And he said, it's all boys. Which is kind of what I expected, but yeah, that's awesome. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, it was great, actually. So before I went out to the school, I was talking to the teachers, and they said, you know, when you're doing your sort of presentation to the kids, because they sort of wanted to have me come there just to get them revved up, get them excited about the program. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And they said, well, can you, while you're there, also talk a little bit more about, you know, being a woman in the games industry? Because actually, our school is like a large portion is female. So we'd love to get the girls involved. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's great. I do a lot of stuff with women in games and stuff as well. So that spoke to my heart, I guess. And so when I went out there, it was indeed a lot of teenage girls and a lot of, you know, some guys as well. But I'm hoping that, through this tournament, that girls also realize that, you know, this is just as much for them as it is for boys. And I think, especially with esports, like there's no reason why that shouldn't be equally distributed. I mean, you know, in some other sports, obviously there's or there's a reason for there to be like a divide between the sexes because of physicality and stuff. But when it comes to esports, that shouldn't be the case. So it'd be lovely to see, you know, co-ed teams or teams that are or having just as many women as men competing in those like lower and upper levels as well. So hopefully, you know, it'd be really cool to have, you know, an all-girl team even representing the school. But so I'm really keen to hopefully go back to the school a little bit later down into the tournament and see what happens. But like Shinya said, that not just the people playing the game, but also that there are so many roles that the kids can participate in, whether it's, you know, community manager, like you said, social media or event planning or, you know, production or what have you. So I think it's great just to open people's eyes to the roles that are available in this space, you know, not just esports, but gaming in general. And even for myself, like I said, I fell into gaming. Like this wasn't something I planned because it just wasn't on my radar. Sure. And I absolutely love it. So I can only imagine like how many people are out there who would have just never maybe been exposed to it, who would absolutely love it and kill it, you know, like absolutely. They would love this industry. So I think it's fantastic just to be able to expose the younger generations to the opportunities out there, for sure.
I think that's really important. It's kind of touching on an issue that I kind of wanted to explore a little bit with you two. The journey of a female gamer from a observer's perspective is pretty difficult every single time. When I used to play, you know, Counter-Strike or whatever game I was playing on Steam, and a girl would come into the lobby, it's just chaos. It's either like pretty disgusting stuff is being said, or it's just complete disrespect for like the quality of play. And you can kind of extrapolate that reaction to the games industry as a whole, with it being very one-sided, shall we say. So one of the things that I've always wanted to kind of push for on this podcast would be to promote a transparency and insight into all areas of the space. And it doesn't always have to be the good stuff. It can be stuff we need to improve on as well. So I guess a place to start would be, have you guys had any negative experiences stepping into this space based on your gender? And what do you feel like any of the major obstacles are for you guys in the space, which is so male dominated? I mean, we could take this entire question to a massive macro social issue, but let's just keep it focused on gaming for now.
Games wise, I guess in my personal life, I get picked on by every male member of my family. When we come to sort of playing games together, they all naturally assume I'm going to lose, and so I have great fun when I actually win. Professionally speaking, I think I've had a very fortunate journey, I have to say. And I know I might be a minority amongst the minority of women, but I've not actually had any sort of major challenges. And I think with me, that the sort of, because before coming into this, I was a teacher in the field of computer science. So again, just like the games industry, even in education and amongst computing teachers, female teachers are a minority. Sure. For me, it's always seemed to work in my favour. I think one of the reasons I was recruited to the school where I worked at the longest was because I seemed to be a half decent teacher and I was a female. But I know that's not what everybody faces. That's a situation that's unique to me.
Okay, well that's a more positive example than I was expecting, but that's good. I saw you making some faces while I was introducing this question.
I just have a very expressive face. It doesn't always mean it. I think for sure it was challenging, especially in the beginning, because it was a bit of a boys' club. I mean, especially when I first started out, it was about 5 years ago, I guess, now that I've been in the industry. But I think there is a little bit of a challenge to have people really believe that your ideas have value and that they can be just as sound as those ideas that are coming from a man, especially in this space, or and just the idea that games are for everyone, you know, they're not just for that 18 to 30 male demographic. Like, everybody can enjoy games. And I think now there's a lot of strides being made to represent just the population more in our games as well, to tell different kinds of stories and make sure that different kinds of people are represented, because you get to reach way more people that way. But I think it took some time to say that, hey, you know, it doesn't always have to be this one story. There are lots of different stories we can tell. And maybe you, man, are not, you know, cannot tell my story the way that I can, you know, and you can't reach the same people that I could reach. So I think for sure there was a bit of a challenge. But I'm lucky that I am where I am now, because we do have, for a games company, we've got a large percentage of females actually that work here. And we've got one game team that when it started was actually all female. So I feel really lucky to be working in a place where it doesn't seem to be that much of an issue. I mean, I've been here now for almost 3 years, and even in the time I've been here, it's been really nice to see that blossom here as well. And the kinds of games that we're making are changing, you know? They're a lot more varied than they were when I first got here. And I think that's sort of a testament to our management and the founders of the company, who are like, no, actually there's more out there. Yeah. I may not know what it is, but you know what? Maybe she does, and maybe she does. So they do make an effort, I think, which is great.
That's good. It's been kind of my experience speaking to various women in the space. Is to ask that question, not just because I'm not asking everyone to kind of sit here and be the champion of half of the planet, but it's just interesting to hear the experiences, because from a recruitment perspective, I'm not allowed being an impartial actor, I'm not allowed to make any value judgment based on gender, location, sexual persuasion, whatever. I mean, that's pretty standard, and that's kind of the PC line that is towed, and the expected line from everyone who's working together. You know, you'd like to see that has been the case. But there's been several times when I've been told underneath the table, I'm sure I'm allowed to say this because I'm not going to mention any names, but there's been a few times when I've been told on the table that my senior leadership team is all 30s white guys. And it's not just for the sake of it, but I just need someone with a completely different perspective to come in. If you could find someone with a completely different perspective, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, then you should do it. So that's one interesting thing that I've come across. And also, coming back to what you said earlier, I do think that if you are an enthusiastic and talented woman in the space, you do really stand out. Like, you do really have a lot of the cards in your pocket with regards to if you can really smash every opportunity that you come across, just because there are so few of you. then it's actually like it's actually like quite. I mean, in a very roundabout way, it's actually quite a good place to be in. But obviously, the barriers to entry are pretty high because you've got to buy trust a lot more than say the stereotype of the space would be.
I think as long as you've got, you know, a decently thick skin and you actually believe that you have talent and your skills of merit and stuff, then you'll be fine. But if, you know, if you're looking for somebody to hold your hand, that's not going to happen.
But from an esports perspective, you see that at the professional play level, you know, there are hardly any women's esports teams that are either about or that are supported enough to kind of, I don't know, grow in the right way. So you've had got these like girls only leagues, and then you've got some places where they where there's a crisscross, like in Counter-Strike, there's quite a developed scene where you've got most teams actually working against each other. But there's still like a massive way for us to go in this injury. And it's not for I feel like it's not for me to say that this is something that has to change. It's not like as someone being in a position that I am, it's on me to raise the issue, but it's not on me to drive it, because I can't really speak to the community of people that are ostracized in the way that, or you know, anyway, I'm kind of babbling in it. But yeah, so that's an interesting topic that I want to raise a bit more on this podcast. So that's good. Thank you very much for your insight.
I do think, like in esports in general, though, like you'll probably start to see just different kinds of people getting interested because the games are changing.
Yeah,
you know, it's not just it's not just games that are traditionally aimed at this, like I said, like 18 to 30. And not that girls also don't play those games now. Like I think the space has become more inviting, so more girls are playing as well. But the types of games that are played competitively are starting to change, and they're not always the same. Like even, for example, Overwatch is super female friendly, you know? Like tons of girls I know play Overwatch, probably more so than something like CSGO. So
yeah,
I think that'll change
more. Which is
why
we chose Overwatch. So when we had the pilot last year, it was more about me just seeing whether this idea worked.
The proof of concept,
more than anything else. And we sort of started to look at, thought, you know, just to take the idea and let's see what naturally the sort of male-female ratio is in that, and, you know, we no surprises there. But when we went back and we asked the schools and we asked the students, it's like, what, you know, why did we not have a lot of females taking part, and what could encourage them more, etc. I mean, last year, you know, I guess everyone knows our game was Rocket League, and we chose it because out of the games that were available, we felt that it was Rocket League's a very accessible game, as in, you know, you can look at it, you can watch a couple of people play, and you think, oh, I can try a bit of that. It's not one of those games where you feel like I need to be really good before I play in front of somebody. And that was the sort of general impression, which is why we chose it. But it turns out, actually, inadvertently, what we'd done is we'd taken football and cars, two of the biggest male stereotypes, and picked them as a game.
Yeah.
And naturally, then shut out a lot of potential female participants. So one of the reasons we chose Overwatch this year is because it's got that reputation. It's well known. It's been recommended by so many people. Mm. And we're hoping, fingers crossed, that we'll see an increasing number of females taking part in the tournament this year as a result.
I'm excited to see that. A few bits of public feedback for you just on the esports. It's not anything too major. I know there's a bunch of other issues around actually rolling out a kind of project like this in terms of hardware. Like, you've got to have all of the quality of the school PCs are pretty awful. And I think a lot of kids are doing their exams on like PCs. Like, I went to my last school. I mean, I did everything by pen and paper.
There are a lot more electronic assessments happening now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And they're saying that these PCs are basically run on like a potato that's been plugged into a cable. Like, it's really low quality. One bit of feedback before we get is a hardware bit is 3v3 in Overwatch.
Yeah,
it's a good place to start, but I feel like maximizing the value of actually getting bunch of kids to play as a team and bring them, maybe those that don't necessarily get the same amount of attention or time that they would get in PE or sport, mm-hmm. Having them have an opportunity to kind of come together and actually build some leadership and some teamwork experiences. You know, those come from behind victories where you drag together and you achieve something, you know, that's beautiful stuff. So 3 versus 3 doesn't really lend itself towards that. So my main point of criticism is that it should be 6 versus 6.
But I completely agree with you.
That's something awesome. Well, great.
I completely agree with you.
Fixed. Done. Awesome.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And our initial conversations were all around 6v6, which is the way Overwatch should be played. Yeah. Absolutely. And I completely understand, you know, that strategic development and problem solving and that thinking, that's so key and it's so important. And from a computing educationist point of view, that is the real gold where you're stretching over into computational thinking and computer science development and problem solving concept, which is so important to computer science development and creativity and things. Yeah. Why we've gone for a 3v3, honestly speaking, it is purely down to logistics. Our schools that take part in the tournament, they don't pay an entry fee. We are not charging anybody for anything. Digital Schoolhouse is fully funded. It's not for profit. So we're relying on partners' financial funding to kind of keep us going. When you add that and you put that into perspective with what you mentioned about schools not having decent hardware, you know, games companies throw in the dustbin PCs and hardware that are 10 times more powerful than the best machines that these schools have. So when you've got that situation across the entire country and these schools don't have the money to be able to afford to loan up-to-date specs and machines, you know, they don't have, they literally don't have the computers that would be able to operate Overwatch.
No.
So then, by then not providing them with any support in that, it means that there's these schools and thousands of children, literally thousands of children, that could not take part in the tournament. So what we want to do is help these schools take part. And that means we're loaning them hardware or we're speaking to partners and trying to get hardware donated so that they can use it and keep and use it to play the tournament. Under those circumstances, it comes down to logistics. Yep. I'm either going to be able to get people to generally donate 250 to 300 machines, or I can halve that number. And when you're relying on people's generosity, then you have to halve the number, because if you don't, the competition will never get off the ground. While I completely agree with your criticism, it was that or nothing.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, actually. So I guess this is the kind of opportunity for games publishers and those in the games industry to take note. And actually, there are so many initiatives that go on in a bunch of other industries where there's a lot more responsibility, even if it's just from a PR perspective of, you know, I think it was Tesco, like throwing out so much food that was like perfect eating quality, the whole kind of best before day and all.
Yeah.
How that's just for the kind of ideal quality to actually sell something. There is a massive potential, and I'm sure there's a huge amount of waste when it comes to short lifespan handhelds and PCs as a whole. So, you know, that's just how the industry works. Like they burn out in a few years. There's not like a few people in the Illuminati sitting in a big table saying, "Yeah, we get this money." But it kind of works out that the technology moves forward in a few years. So there has to be a way.
Well, your average game company, what you rotate your machines? What, every couple of years? Every 3 years? 3 to 5 years, maybe?
Yep, 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years. There you go. 3 years. Yeah. You know, if you've got a school that's rotating its machines every 5 years, that's a well-to-do school.
Yeah,
it literally is a well-to-do school. Yeah. So I guess almost as a plea is, if there are games companies that are listening to this and they have machines that they are, it's a case of throw it away or something else, then the Digital Schoolhouse could probably do a lot with those machines and we can use them to help equip schools for next year's tournament. Because they are those machines that the games companies are throwing out, it's not even an exaggeration. They literally are 10 times more powerful than the best machines that most schools have across the country.
Yeah, I remember trying to, when I was supposed to be doing work in ICT at school, I was trying to play Miniclip, and sometimes Makeclip wouldn't even load. And that's just a web-based games thing. That was, and then I actually had to do my work. That was a nightmare. Cool. So I think that's a really important message that we can maybe move forward and actually speak a little bit more about off-air. As always with these podcasts, we always end up running up against the clock pretty quickly because the conversations are just so damn interesting.
So good. So
first of all, I just want to thank both of you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
I think one of the things I want to do that I've mentioned already is I want to bring my whichever team from my school gets through on the podcast, maybe with the sixth formers. I don't really know how I'm going to work it, maybe just the sixth formers because they'll have like a wider experience of it, and then come back round to the finals and actually maybe speak about after the event.
That'd be amazing.
All of the footfall and all of the impact.
Actually, I think Townley Grammar is going to come visit our studio as well.
Oh, fantastic!
Mm-hmm. That would be sweet.
Yay!
So I get to see a real studio in action, which will be neat. I think for them.
Yeah. That would be brilliant.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That would be sweet. So thank you very much for your time. We have a fun recurring segment where we ask our guests if they could kind of throw out the book and restart in the esports industry specifically. Okay. Where would they choose and why? You can choose any big title that's been around recently. You can go back to, you know, I really wish I could be the Pong play-by-play commentator. I wish I could be a pro player. I wish I'd be the person that could fix Twitch because it's crap. So
shots fired.
So Deb, I'll give it to you first. if you could throw out the book and start in esports again, what would you choose and why?
Oh wow! What would I do? It'd be really cool to be one of the guys in the Space Invaders tournament way back when. That would be really cool. Just be like the birth of esports and really be there. But then again, fast forward, 50 years or whatnot, it would also be cool to be like Tally in the Clash Royale tournament, who's, in his 30s and is on stage with a bunch of 17-year-olds who's also potentially up for a big cash prize. That's quite cool to be like, I have another career or whatever, most likely, I don't know.
Yeah.
But now I'm really, really good at this game and I can play this professionally. That is mad. I don't know. I think that would be really cool to have. I'm saying I could start now if I wanted, Joe. I could start now and become a pro esports player.
Well, actually, the first episode of the year when we were speaking to Ralph from ESL, he said that he'd just broken into the top 200 on Clash Royale in Germany. So it's 100% possible whilst holding down a full-time role.
Exactly.
Do you have any thoughts on this or would you like us to pass over it?
Oh my goodness. let's pass. I mean, I don't know. I think it's such an exciting field and there is so much happening. And I think when we think about esports and then also I think if you think about esports and then you combine the sort of latest innovations in technology and hardware and mixed reality, I think the possibilities are just so exciting. So yeah, I think I'd like to fast forward kind of 50 years and then take on any role because on any title, because it will just be awesome. Because you can just imagine, you just take, we're at the birth, or it's not the birth because some of these technologies have been being developed over the past sort of 20 years or stuff. But in terms of in the consumer space, and then it's not going to be long before you get studios combining the technologies in unique ways. That's kind of where I want to be.
I think before I started working in esports, I wanted to end up like running my own kids' martial arts gym, just to kind of pass on something good. So in terms of wider social impact, I think you're in a pretty good place as it is with all of the various challenges that you've got to overcome.
I want to be riding the dragon, coming into the bird's nest in Beijing. Somehow through VR, I'll be riding the dragon when it comes in.
That would be incredible.
I don't know why that's a job.
You'd be the hype girl. It was fun.
Okay,
cool. So where, we've hit the end of our slot. Where can everyone reach you if they want to get in touch on social media or by email?
Either.
Which would be?
Oh, right. So my
you have to say what
you know. I have to say my email address. Okay. Either one. It's shanila@yuki.org.uk for email, or Twitter is shanila1, okay. The digit one.
Digit one.
I nice. Don't know why I didn't think to put an S afterwards, but I just, yeah, shanila1.
That's okay. Deb?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's @DebMensaBonsu. It's DebMensaBonsu. It's a mouthful. Yeah, follow me there. I will hopefully post some updates about the school as well and the esports tournament and stuff. So that'll be exciting.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, we're going to be having Deb back on to speak about Space Open Esports in the course of the next few weeks.
Truth.
it's been the next few weeks for me are going to be pretty crazy. So, but we'll find some time to get that in. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really excited to be involved. When I started working in esports, I didn't know if I'd be doing this sort of thing. But working with these kids and just seeing their little smiles light up was pretty inspiring. So,
aww, he has a heart and everything.
Not this callous exterior. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and guys, we will see you next time.